PD Pods present the CoronaCast. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the penultimate episode of the CoronaCast, hosted by PD Pods and myself, Pranay Budev. We are getting to the point where we'll be pivoting back to the PD Pods cast, where I interview some very famous pediatric orthopedic surgeons from around the world about their careers, how they've developed, and their interests in research, education, and other topics. Before we did that, I thought it was very important to discuss the effects the COVID pandemic has had on surgeon education. Of course, the COVID pandemic has upended nearly every medical discipline, dramatically impacted patient care, and has definitely stopped and changed the role of most practitioners, especially those in the orthopedic sector. I therefore thought it was very important to speak to Ms. Lisa Hadfield-Law, who most people will know, but for those who don't, she's a surgical educationist who teaches surgeons how to teach and learn how to learn. She has trained over 15,000 surgeons from 68 countries and, I guess, pivoted to this career after spending over 20 years in clinical practice. She serves important roles in the British Orthopaedic Association, the Royal College of Surgeons, and AO UK, and was awarded the BOA Presidential Merit Award in 2018 for her contribution. I definitely feel she's the best position to address the issue of the post-pandemic recovery and resuming the new normal of training and education, and discuss the significant developments and future innovations that are now being considered by Training Program Directors, Society, and the Royal College. Lisa, thank you so much for joining me.
Great pleasure.
So Lisa, why don't you give us a bit more about your background? How did you get into surgical education? And what is your role in these different committees and societies?
My role now is really advisory, and to provide educational advice to the British Orthopaedic Association, AO UK, and various deaneries in this country and hospitals overseas. So mainly advisory, and also quite a lot of faculty development. That my routine, as with so many of these things, was just pure chance. So I went into nursing, trained at UCH, absolutely loved it, loved the whole thing, then trained as an ED nurse, and my career went through emergency services, and I ended up as head of nursing at Barts in the late 80s, 1987, I think. Absolutely loved that as well. And eventually, I suppose after about 6 years, I left to start a family and then went to work in Oxford and worked for another 3 years clinically, and then moved over into education completely.
I mean, everyone, I'm sure most people listening to this would have met you at some stage or the other, and you've played such an important role, especially with the Training the Trainers course and Training Orthopaedic Educational Supervisors. I know there's the STEP program and some other programs you're involved with. Obviously, a lot of that is done face-to-face, and the COVID pandemic has really put an end to all of that. What have you done during lockdown since all of this started?
Well, the day it started, I got a call from Chris Moran to say, could you just nip down to London and work out how we train 1.4 million healthcare workers ready to deal with COVID? Which I attempted to do, and we start a whole group of people, and amazing, really quite junior trainees were working with me on that. So I did that for a couple of weeks, and then I moved over to the London Nightingale for a couple of weeks to help set up the training strategy. So that was my first month of COVID. I was away, and then I got home, came to my desk and realised I had absolutely no work for the rest of the year because so much of my stuff is face-to-face. So set about rethinking the approach and working out how we achieve the same outcomes with training orthopaedic trainers, educational supervisors, introducing the new curriculum, leadership for core trainees. So all that, we were really quickly able to turn around and deliver or facilitate virtually. And to be fair, I was really lucky because about 5 years ago, I trained as a virtual teacher. It was part of my professional development and an interest of mine. So I had already worked on a lot of the principles and already worked on a lot of virtual programs or blended programs. So I've been doing that and I've relearning how to play the banjo-lele. How about that?
There you go. Great use of time. And I think a lot of people have picked up different hobbies and found new interests over this period of time as well. Let's move on to the effect this has had on our trainees. A lot of them were redeployed due to social distancing. A lot of them were taken out of clinic rooms. And we've really prided ourselves on giving consultant-delivered care over the last couple of months, especially in my institution. That's what we've been doing. But I have felt quite bad that they've sort of been abandoned. And there's this huge sense of a loss of responsibility and opportunity for them. Obviously, traumas continue to happen and they've been very proactive on going to trauma lists, but that elective workload and experience has dropped dramatically. We spoke about this in a couple of episodes of the Coronacast with the BOTA president. What do you feel, even at this late stage, before we resume to a semi-normal service, what can trainees do now at this stage that would be of benefit to them?
My brother said to me in the first couple of days of this pandemic becoming a problem, we have all got to make sure that by the time we finish with this, we can look back with pride that we have done what we could and made an important contribution. And for all of us, that's going to be important. What I've been deeply impressed by our trainees. Really deeply impressed, and actually by trainers as well, because to lose your identity as T&O and often having to go in really very, very alien contexts, I've been amazed at how people have just stepped up to the plate with energy, graciousness, humility. And so I've seen an awful lot of squeezing the juice out of all the opportunities. So trainees have done things I absolutely just could not do now. Going into ITU, being ITU nurses, proning teams, working on wards. One of the consultants in Leicester, recently retired, went back as a porter. So people really going into areas that are unfamiliar and demonstrating incredible flexibility and resilience. And if you think about that, as a skill, as an attribute as a surgeon, flexibility, resilience, the ability to get on board with a totally new team, those are much, much more difficult skills to learn than doing a DHS or pulling a wrist fracture. So I think the opportunities that have come up during this time have been huge, and our trainers and trainees have been taking absolutely full advantage of those. I suppose the important thing to do is to make sure that those experiences are captured. Because I've really tried hard to write reflective notes, nothing fancy, just notes. I've got them in a book. I go back to them every so often and have made some important connections about why some of what I've learned is valuable, and also some real insights into some of the areas about me that I need to work on. and are not so impressive and are actually weaknesses. And I wasn't aware of those until I made those connections, because I've been pushed out of my comfort zone.
That's a great answer, because you bring up two very important things we want to talk about. One, the importance of reflection, and something that needs to be documented, because if it's not documented, it hasn't happened. And the second thing is, you mentioned all these phenomenal professional type qualities, and that's going to be very important when it comes to the curriculum change that has now been delayed for a year till 2021. But why don't you talk about those two things? Start off with that reflection, the importance of reflection, how it can be done, because orthopedic trainees will normally reflect on a case or a surgical procedure. They may not be reflecting on their recent experience. And to be fair, the BOA Transient Journal has been a very useful tool, because people have been able to publish their sort of reflections. And then secondly, about the curriculum.
Yeah. Okay. So if we talk about reflection, and do not for 1 minute think that reflection is about holding hands and singing Kumbaya and talking about our innermost feelings. That's not what reflection is. Reflection is critical analysis with a view to walking away from it better and wiser. So if actually there's two reasons for doing it, I suppose, in my head. The critical analysis to help us learn is fundamental to being a professional, because if you are really to be safe and maximum effective, you have to be able to reflect in action. So that means being in the middle of an operation and going, right, this is unexpected. Either the patient's starting to bleed, or the anatomy is unexpected, or there's a hole in the kit and we've not got another kit. So, you know, intraoperatively, or if we were here, we're doing a podcast now, if suddenly the sound went or something happened in the background, we would have to reflect in action, analyze what's happening, what are the options, super quickly. We can't say, I'm sorry, we're just going to stop. Let's wake the patient up now and let's just have a little think about what we're going to do. No, we can't do that. We have to do it like that. So if we're to reflect in action, we have to learn how to reflect on action first. You cannot, no matter what people say to you, you cannot go straight into reflection in action. You have to learn on action first. So that's number one for learning. Number two for evidence. So if I were going for a job at for London Fashion Week, I wanted to be a model at London Fashion Week, I couldn't just turn up and say, do you know what, I take a lovely photo. You honestly, I look so glamorous. You'll be really pleased. You know, nobody would say, oh, okay, have the job. If you wanted your house built, I couldn't come to you as an architect and say, I build a lot of lovely buildings. I've got to show you the evidence. So because reflection is so pivotal, it's not something dreamed up by your educationalists in ivory towers. It is fundamental, and in my head, possibly one of the most important capabilities that you will need, we all need. And anyway, the GMC is saying we've got to demonstrate that, so there isn't any choice. And there's one more thing. And it's something about stopping yourself going doolally. And just when something really challenging happens, when something big happens, not necessarily horrible, just something significant, getting stuff down that you can then go back to and think about stops that rumination, stops it whirring around your head. You know, I've got mine in this book here, so I don't need to keep it going round. I know it's there and I can go back to it later, and it makes sense and I make connections that are really important later. So as far as I'm concerned, anybody who says that reflection isn't helpful lacks insight and would worry me hugely.
And with regards to its role in the curriculum and how that's going to be introduced in 2021,
and I'm again really excited about that, because as I've said to you earlier on, there'll be a real swing from knowledge and skills. And not to say that that will be less important, because of course knowledge is important, but creating that knowledge is more important now. We've got so much accessible on Tinterweb, if you like. Skills, you've always been pretty good at assessing. We've got a lot of work to do on helping people do that more quickly and effectively and assessing it better. But the judgments and the professional aspects, what will be called the generic professional capabilities, the best way of exploring that, learning about that, and demonstrating that is through reflective writing. So it will, if we can get used to doing it now, and then we are able to help others do it really brilliantly down the line too, it's going to be essential, because it will be an even more important part of the new curriculum. And that links back to the point that you asked me about what trainees could and should be doing now. Well, one of the things that the BOA have done is pull out those generic professional capabilities, the professional glue bits that will hold the curriculum together, that will be introduced in August next year. We've pulled out the ones that are really relevant to now and this pandemic. Some of the things that will be difficult to get in the future. So things around resilience and managing uncertainty and well-being, those might be more difficult when we're back to a different kind of normal. If people can work on those now and work on gathering evidence and gathering feedback from other people and our own reflections, then when surgery comes back, it will be much easier to really focus time and effort on that, because this part you'll be able to just suspend for a while because you've already sorted it and got a lot of it out of the way.
Yeah, and you know, I think in one of our early episodes we talked about how a lot of people are using their time differently, in the sense that they're doing a bit more of the paperwork type stuff, like the audits, quality improvement projects, and research, which are all things that we're all expected to do, but actually have the time to sort of bring that paperwork to the top of the pile. You mentioned there about surgery coming back, and you know, there are some trusts that have already commenced elective surgery, and there are definitely musings and thoughts about how that is going to be done safely for both patients and healthcare workers. With regards to resuming training, as consultant body, we're going to have a huge number of waiting lists. Patients that have been, to be fair, very happy to wait at this time, but that patients will wear out quite a lot. We're having to work differently in theatre, where we would normally do 4 or 5 cases a day. We're going to be doing half of that. And there will be a pressure from management to clear those waiting lists. I was very happy to see the JCST account on Twitter say that every case is a training case, and we need to alert the theatre team in the WHO briefing about that. And there has been a hashtag, no training today, no surgeons tomorrow. And I think that's a very important point we need to talk about. How can we safely train whilst managing this external pressure that we're going to be put on? I know that the BOA and Royal College are going to be putting out a document about this in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. So getting that balance right has always been difficult. It's just going to be hugely magnified with this deluge of surgery that will be required. But again, if I say if everyone can do as much of the preparatory stuff during this downtime, the better. So sorting out generic professional capabilities, but also anticipating what opportunities are going to be there. So trainees really need to look very, very carefully at their portfolios. Where are the gaps? What is missing? Not what do they fancy doing when surgery resumes, but where are the gaps? What are they missing? Being really, really brutal with themselves about, right, these are where the gaps are. This is what I can do now to prepare for any opportunities that come up. So anatomy, absolutely brilliant. You know, the kindergarten of orthopedics, if you like. Anatomy sorted. All the surgical plans and the formulating the plans and the recipes for surgery, if you like. Familiarity with the instrumentation, doing all that groundwork so that as a trainee, as soon as things start up, they will have talked to their supervisors and being crystal clear, this is what I need, this is what I've done, these are the opportunities I'm looking for. So then you as a trainer can just have in your head or even on a bit of paper the opportunities that each of your trainee needs, rather than having to try and think for yourself, what do I think they might need? It takes too much time. So that's their job. And then your job, I suppose, driving to work, in the shower in the morning, is thinking, right, what have I got on my list? Who have I got coming? The trainee must review the list and work out for themselves where they can, not what they need, what they need from the list, and little bits of operations, not necessarily the whole thing, little bits that they can do and be a bit slower with, and you can then do the other bits and speed up. But also they need to think, what contribution can I make? What can I do to make the list easier, the people working around us feel more comfortable and more motivated? What contribution can they make to the overall thing, if you like?
It reminds me of a great quote from Atul Gawande's book, Better, which is a fantastic book, as I'm sure you know. But he goes, you know, better is possible. It does not take genius. It takes diligence, moral clarity, ingenuity, and above all, a willingness to try. And I think that rings very true here, because it's all about owning that list. This is not your boss's list. This is your list, and you are just as important in that list as they are. And then that preparation, that mental preparation of understanding what you're going to be doing, how you're going to position the patient, and all that is just as important as actually doing it itself. Because you may not be a hip surgeon in the future, you may be a hand surgeon, but actually understanding and mentally preparing makes you better as a surgeon. And, you know, over time, and with, even though the EWTD may end up disappearing towards the end of the year, and Matthew Saeed's book always talked about doing, you know, I think, was it 10,000 hours of practice, that does not ring true as much. And that's where I think, you know, this sort of thing is, no matter what you do, it's not about the time, it's about the mental preparation and actually getting it all together that will help your career development.
So here's an interesting one. You've just talked about Matthew Syed and his book Bounce, and incidentally, his more recent one about rebel ideas is also very relevant at the moment, and I can commend it to you. It was about deliberate practice. Now, the 10,000 hours was made quite famous by Malcolm Gladwell, but it's not just, if I play for 10,000 hours on my banjolele, I'm not going to be George Formby at the end of it. But if I really go for it and I really look to the bits that I'm not so good at, the chords I can't really do, the strumming that's really difficult for me, and I get feedback from, you know, George Formby current, then I might have a chance. But it's deliberate practice. So when we're all thinking about going back and facing this tsunami of surgery, we all need to keep that in mind. Forget the numbers. It's the pushing to the edge of your comfort zone and that deliberate practice that will make the hugest difference. And that's for all of us, for trainees learning how to be surgeons, for trainers going back into practice after. You know, surgeons say that when they've just been away for a couple of weeks, they feel a little bit tense, that first list back. After months, it will be really overfacing. So maybe everyone's just going to have to recognize that. And when you talked about trainees going in and saying, this is my list, maybe we all have to go in saying, this is our list, because there's going to be anaesthetists, there's going to be scrub people, there's going to be radiographers, there's all kinds of people who will be feeling on edge and needing to meet their own development needs, if you like, as well as looking after the patients and the patient coming first.
Yes, I like that. And maybe doing 2-3 cases a day is actually the way to start, because we're all going to be feeling slightly anxious about it. And with last week's interview with Mr. Monzel, we talked about dual consultant operating, because we're going to feel like we've been de-skilled as well. Before we move on to some of the novel approaches to educating our trainees, tell me, what makes a good surgical trainer?
Well, interestingly, the Faculty of Surgical Trainers through the Edinburgh College came up with some superb standards. I suppose about 6-7 years ago. They've been adopted by the GMC and they are used on ISCP. And so those standards are there for you to see anywhere. The other interesting bit of work was done by David O'Regan, who developed the Silver Scalpel Award. So the award for the best surgical trainer in the country every year. And we've had a couple of orthopaedic, Chris Kerwin got it, David Jaffrey got it, I think. And what David O'Regan did was he brought all of the winners and their trainees together to try and see what it was they did that was so amazing, so outstanding. And again, he wondered whether it was about personality. So they all underwent personality testing, but they were all different. And it turned out that you can boil it down really to seven habits, if you like. And really brilliant trainers are kingmakers, not kings. And we've sort of always known that surgical glitterati never make great trainers. They might be wildly exciting to watch in theatre or on a stage, and they may be terribly entertaining. But in terms of helping others learn, they're usually not very interested in others. So kingmakers, not kings, that's one. Another one is they are brilliant at finding the gap, working out what trainees need, not what they want. So they're great at that, and then pushing and challenging and supporting trainees to fill those gaps. They're brilliant at establishing feedback conversations and are generous with feedback both ways. They pick up problems really early and address them. And it always makes me smile inwardly when every single trainer or trainee I've ever worked with always says at some point, I just find conflict difficult. I find difficult conversations difficult. Yeah, that's normal. That's normal for absolutely everyone. You have to be slightly weird to love really difficult conversations and conflict. So that's another one. They make time. They make learning and helping others learn as important as looking after patients. And that's the other thing they're good at doing, is that they assess what trainees need, not what they want, what they need, in terms of stepping back and letting somebody try, or holding their hand and guiding them, or taking over and knowing when to say, step away, I'm doing this next bit, or come away from that patient, I'm going to deal with that. So they know when to put hands on, take hands off, or hold hands.
Fantastic, yeah. We have struggled to break the mold in the way we have been teaching for a long, long time. And actually, this pandemic has served almost as an effective catalyst to harness some of the novel methods, obviously through podcasts like ours. Webinars have been happening all over the country from different regions, as well as the Ortho Hub ones, the ones done from the AOS, the BOA, and lots of other specialist societies around the world. What is the future of the UK orthopaedic training? Is it, I know there's evidence saying that when you hear a lecture, you only retain about 5% of the information. But if you give a lecture and you've had to teach others, you retain about 90% of that information. So what is the best way that people can be taught right now? And is there any active efforts by the BOA to sort of centralize what's being done at a more regional level by training program directors?
So that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you talk a lot. You mentioned lectures. You mentioned retaining information. And of course, what we said right at the start is surgery is has got crucial knowledge underpinnings. So knowledge is, as a foundation, is incredibly important, as are surgical skills, as are those attitudes, those values, those professional behaviours. And of course, that you can't give to somebody. And our traditional approach to education has been about filling heads up with stuff and information by purveying stuff to our learners. And actually, you can't learn surgery that way. So if we accept that it's human nature to teach other people the way we were taught, that's our first myth we've got to get rid of. We've got to stop with the, well, it was good enough for us, and well, I did this and it was fine. We know we've got good, strong educational principles now. We know what works to help people acquire knowledge, skills, judgment, and professionalism. So using those foundations is going to be incredibly important. One of the difficulties our specialty has is that T&O love a good gadget. They just do love a good bit of drill or metalwork or a nail or a plate. They just love it. And I do get that. But that means that there's a temptation whenever there's a new gizmo around to go, oh, this is the answer to everything. Amazing. Simulation, fantastic. Virtual reality, brilliant. There are some superb tools around, but we've always got to be terribly careful to underpin stuff with educational principles and not be seduced by fancy schmancy. So if Chris Munch, who's a cardiothoracic surgeon, when simulation first became very trendy, I mean, it's been around. AO started on cadaveric bones. So we've had simulation around for a long time. But there was an interesting statement made in the Houses of Parliament that for our specialty, of course, we all jumped on, which was somebody said, nobody must touch a patient without practicing in simulating first. Well, actually, why? We've got so many opportunities and we've got so many things that need simulating. So if we take, for example, just this week, we've been simulating teaching sessions. So we just pretend we're in a classroom with some other people and practice our teaching skills. I was with a neurosurgeon online yesterday, simulating a difficult conversation with a trainee who is cocky, irritating, and is frankly displaying some very worrying professional behaviours. So I pretended to be the trainee, and he handled that. That's simulation too. That's very low cost. Hugely effective because he then just went off to do it. So let's keep an eye on things like touch surgery, fantastic tool. Things like Proximy, which for us may well really be important down the line. If not immediately, I was thinking about you all going back into theatre and feeling a bit uncomfortable. Maybe having two people in theatre might be difficult. But Proximy may be able to help you with that, with some remote support, if you like. So we need to be careful with simulation and virtual reality. Just because we can do it doesn't mean it's a good thing to do. Just because we fancy it doesn't mean it's good. It's whether that we need to work out first, what do people need to be able to do? And how can we most cheaply and effectively, in terms of time and money, achieve that instead of letting the tail wag the dog? Ooh, I've got an amazing gizmo. What can it do for us? And I saw that happen with the amazing simulation facilities at the Royal College of Surgeons. They lay fallow for most of the years it was open. The army used them really brilliantly, but other than that, it was a couple of times a year. Other than that, there wasn't the expertise in terms of faculty briefing and debriefing. It's incredibly expensive to maintain in terms of the technical side, and anyway, you've got to free learners and trainers to go away from clinical practice, and we're certainly not going to have that over the next while or so.
What's your opinion on virtual reality then?
It's difficult for me because, you know, I'm a mobile phones to me are all terribly exciting. And when my son brings back his Google glasses, I just think, oh my gosh, that's amazing and fantastic. But I find it slightly overfacing. So I'm probably not the person to ask because I am, you know, I've gone over the hill really. So asking some people like Ronnie Davis, who has got a real slant, a shoulder and elbow surgeon up in Manchester, got a real educational slant, but is also, he won't mind me saying this, he describes himself as a bit geeky. So he will be in a much better position to balance up the role and the potential. But don't be seduced into going for very, very expensive options in terms of time and money when you've got things right in front of you that will do better.
And obviously, as we were mentioning before, a lot of virtual teaching is being done and has been very well received actually by trainees, and a lot of consultant colleagues dial in as well. What do you feel is the future of the way that is done, because we're not going to get as many face-to-face meetings as we do, and networking is a very important part. You know, human connection is very important to surgeons especially. We're in a very tactile field, of course. And what do you feel the role of future congresses and meetings are?
Yeah, well, I heard yesterday that BOA Congress is going to be virtual this year, which is exciting but scary. And I suppose, of course, if I think to BOA Congress, if I'm really honest, that the sessions, some of them are interesting, but the most valuable part of Congress is are the networking, the connections, the reconnections, the chance to spark, to discuss ideas really quickly, and then bring other people on. So those networking opportunities won't happen as things stand now, but again, maybe we can look for ways of recreating that virtually. And maybe, I don't know, maybe it links with the well-being thing. Maybe we, groups of people come together once a week, no more than 8 people maybe, maybe different people, to just have a coffee together and talk about things that are happening or things that really matter to them. The Royal London consultants had started to do that anyway. Coming together as groups just to talk about things that really mattered to them. And that can potentially be incredibly creative and also very protective in terms of our mental health that I know you've expressed some concerns about before now. So virtual learning and teaching, I absolutely adore it. For me, I don't have to either going to London or to the other side of the world. But while you are doing it, for those of you who've been doing online facilitation, not just telling people stuff, but real facilitation, it is rewarding, it's exciting, but it is incredibly hard work. And it might get easier, I don't know. The feedback from trainees who've done the virtual programs with us over this last 2 months have said they wouldn't want to go back to face-to-face now. They've said they preferred it. And there's something about the spaced outness of things and the chance to do things and then come back that you can, you will have that luxury if you're doing it online. You know, with virtual tots, we've had a couple of 3-hour sessions and I thought that might be too long. Actually, it was fine. And then little 1-hour discussion sessions with 8 to 15 people.
Well, you know, and I think all these sort of educational courses and experiences, you know, it adds up financially as well, you know, and I think that's something else that will be considered, because it becomes considerably less expensive when you're running it remotely from home. You're not hiring a venue, you know, you're not seeking out, you know, big expensive sponsors and things like that. And, you know, there will be a way that even the industry will have to pivot their educational ways of teaching. And that has actually already been done by a few for the ISHA, which is the Hip Preservation Society. They've, you know, the industry sponsored webinars and things like that. I think it will make it more accessible, but as you said, without the significant cost and time and money.
And maybe those are discussions that are required. And to be fair, J&J certainly came on to me early and said, right, how can we help? What can we do? And the recognition that the big congresses certainly won't be happening this year. But I'm told that many of our industrial partners are sort of feeling less enamored of those anyway these days, and they are not feeling that they are making the connections they might need to or they have in the past.
And before we sort of end, it'd be remiss of me to forget the sort of third group of people involved in our team, and that is our junior then registrar staff, so our foundation officers, our core surgical trainees, who I feel don't really get a great deal when it comes to training. It's very much dependent on where you're working, what their setup is. Yeah. The big units, multi-trauma centers, tend to have, you know, a large trauma meeting each morning. That is now changing again with social distancing. And there was an article written by an old colleague of mine, Philip Beek, in the BOA's Transient Journal about how we can harness, again, this opportunity. Who should be taking a lead on this, and how can we work all together to make sure that we keep our junior colleagues interested and actually want to come into our specialty?
I feel really strongly about this. I work with one deanery and see all their core surgical trainees in each of their years. So I have a good handle. They come from lots of different hospitals. I have a good handle on how they are supported. I wonder whether if somebody takes responsibility for just keeping an eye on what's happening with them and how things are structured, I think that really helps. There's something very important about expectations. And if we look at the phases of surgical training and work backwards, we've got the last, the ST7 and 8, those 2 years are really focused on honing surgical technique. That's what it's for, surgical technique, those last 2 years. Then ST3 up to ST7, that's about getting up to speed as a day one consultant with knowledge and clinical skills and professional behaviours. Those, the first 2 years, whether it's run through ST1 and 2 or core training, that is about the foundations of being a surgeon. And I think we probably need to be really, really clear that those foundations in those 2 or 3 years are essential. So being able to do something in theatre, it might be nice, but is that what core surgical training is all about? I often hear even training program directors saying, you know, the important thing is getting in and cutting. Well, I mean, it might be nice and people might like that, but the essentials for that bit are learning how to be a really good surgical doctor, not doing the crappy dross that no one else wants to do, but getting the foundations and understanding what that's all about. If you all behave as though going to theatre is like the games, like the PE bit of your job, and going to clinic is like the boring double maths, or doing the ward stuff is even worse, well, trainees sort of get that. So working out clearly what is required and being clear about expectations and providing the appropriate challenge and support so they are the very best they can be by the time they get out, I think is important. I also think that for our foundation doctors, core trainees and medical students, it's very often as basic as even noticing them. Medical students are turning up and people just don't even notice them and just treat them like they're a real irritation, or foundation doctors as they're sort of a bit of a slave to just get on with things and do everybody else's bidding. Of course, if you treat people like that, they won't want to join our specialty. So we have a moral obligation, I think, to just a little bit of attention. It isn't even that much. What do they need? Not what they fancy. what do they need? And this bit of time and effort into meeting that need will pay dividends down the line.
Yeah. And, you know, thank you, because it's actually in your courses like Tots and Toes that you've basically said, you know, clarifying expectations, the importance of understanding what you can get out of a trainee, but what they can get out of you. And it's forming that relationship not only with registrars, but also the junior staff. And I'm sure we'll see it in the departments where that is done. Those are the trainees that end up wanting to do orthopedics, because it's always when it comes down to you know, imitation and wanting to be. And that's why I've gone into my specialty. It's because I was exposed to the exact certain thing. Lisa, I want to thank you so much. We've covered a huge amount of stuff there about the importance of the future curriculum changes, the importance of reflection, and how we can optimize the way we do work-based assessments when we do eventually return to theatre. What makes a consultant a good trainer, and how they can get the most out of their trainee, and how we're going to harness some of the novel educational platforms in the future as it goes on. I'd like to mention BOTA is doing Supper Sundays with Writington at 8 p.m., which is another fantastic educational opportunity, in addition to the Ortho Hub webinars hosted by Kash Akhtar, who as of now has just been appointed the Specialist Advisory Committee, you know, as it's just come through hot off the press. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you found this useful, and sort of to bring the coronacast towards its sort of natural end. Next week's episode is going to be my musings on the COVID pandemic, what I have done with my time in addition to the podcast, and before we gently transition into the PD podcast, where we speak to a lot of the famous, well-known pediatric orthopedic surgeons around the world. Of course, if there's any way we can help, do get in contact with us on Twitter or LinkedIn. We're at PD Pods. And Lisa, again, thank you so much again for joining me for this.
Pleasure.